things that I've seen. Is it my life or just something I dream?
Resume. Noun. 1. A summing up. Summary. 2. A brief written account of personal, educational, and professional qualifications and experience. In 1982, a standard-sized comic new off the rack cost 60 cents. Meanwhile, I could buy loose back issues at the local flea market for a quarter or sometimes less. Even in my youth, I appreciated value for the dollar. This helps to explain why I took much of the rest of 1982 off as a newsstand collector. In September, it took Master of the Universe number 1 to get me to pay full cover again, and it pretty much immediately put me right back off. I actually came back for the second issue, and shame on me. But at least I skipped the third issue in a 3-issue miniseries devoted to a toy line I was actively collecting, and I even watched the Risible cartoon for a while. This should have been DC's answer to the recently launched G.I. Joe, but it was such a dull sub-Atlas Howard lift that it couldn't even hold the attention of a fervent, forgiving fan base. I was surprised when Skeletor appeared to die from catching He-Man's sword in the chest after a Superman team-up in DC Comics Presents. When this number one seemed to open with an epilogue and declared Skeletor totally alive, I felt cheated. Alfredo Alcala did a fine job livening up George Tuska's pencils, but to a kid there was something oddly icky about Alcala. I couldn't articulate it then, but he had a 70s Eurocentric vibe that, when applied to half-naked barbarians, made me feel squicky. Aside from Tila in an unflattering one-piece, this book looked like a Joe Weider catalog. I guess you could call it an early bout of homophobia in the most literal sense. Turned off by all this lumbering, gristly beefcake without the tenderizing of a Barry Smith, or the comparative cheesecake of a John Buscema, as if that was something Big John was really known for. I should point out that I came to love Alcala later on horror titles, and the art here is certainly more appealing than Don Perlin and Herb Tramp alternating on G.I. Joe. I think maybe it's just that Paul Kupperberg was no Larry Hama, or I guess even a Bob Budiansky, if you swing that way. The DC miniseries felt misaligned with the mini-comics packaged with the figures, and came across as a Conan wannabe even from my far less critical formative perspective. The story just did not hold my attention. And in fact, Kupperberg would disappoint me so often in my youth that it was a revelation when I connected the dots years later. Master of the Universe number 2 is probably the only book I bought in October, and I skipped November entirely.
And the Masters of the Universe! I am Adam, Prince of Eternia and defender of the secrets of Castle Grayskull. This is Cringer, my fearless friend. Fabulous secret powers were revealed to me the day I held aloft my magic sword and said,
"By the power of Grayskull, became the mighty Battle Cat, and I became He-Man, the most powerful man in the universe. Only 3 others share this secret. Our friends, the Sorceress, Man-at-Arms, and Orko. Together we defend Castle Grayskull from the evil forces of Skeletor.
My general rule for comic reader resume is that I don't talk about back issues unless they were bought roughly contemporaneous to the dates I'm covering, and preferably outside a conventional comic shop. It would take forever to document every comic I ever read, and get pretty tedious. For instance, books published in August of 1982 alone that I read well after the fact include All-Star Squadron number 15, All-Star Squadron Annual number 1, 3 issues of Captain America including an annual, Daredevil number 189, DC Comics Presents number 51, Doctor Strange number 56, Green Lantern number 158, Iron Man Annual number 5, Justice League of America number 208, Legion of Superheroes number 293, Marvel and DC Present the Uncanny X-Men and the New Teen Titans, 2 more Titans comics, Moon Knight issues 25 and 26, Uncanny X-Men number 163, and the original Wolverine miniseries. In fact, one of my pet peeves regarding podcasts is when people just read off lists like I just did. That said, I will make exceptions where I feel they're warranted. For instance, I should confess that I basically seized a substantial run of those Moon Knight comics I mentioned earlier from one of my best friends growing up, more or less without his consent. Later, I gave him relative carte blanche to recover from those losses by helping himself to a bunch of my comics about a year later. But I specifically forbade recovering those Moon Knights that were 100% his property. It's one of my less than stellar moments of white boy imperialism that embarrasses me and shames me to this day. My head was in no way screwed on straight at that time, but that's no excuse for being a total creep. I didn't steal a lot growing up, but I've never forgiven myself for the times I did, and I still cringe and squirm over those misdeeds. Black Hawk number 252 was also among that batch of comics my friend was gifted, but I only read that one rather than declaring eminent domain. The main draw for me was a leather-clad femme fatale called Domino, but she was a minor element compared to the War Wheel. If you're unfamiliar, the Blackhawks were an international squadron of independent aviators who flew missions for the Allies against the Axis in World War II. Steven Spielberg at one time optioned the rights from DC, prompting the company to launch a short-lived, well-regarded, pitiful-selling revival. I've read some of the issues since and appreciate Mark Evanier and Dan Spiegel's adventure serial pastiche, but as a kid, it just seemed old-timey and tired. The image of a giant, mobile, weaponized Ferris wheel stuck with me, and you can see variations on the premise in the movies like Battleship and Avengers Infinity War, but it's still silly in an especially comic booky way. Another retroactive notable was Marvel's two-issue adaptation of the movie Blade Runner. Like the Rocky Horror Picture Show, I only knew of the movie from seeing its poster at a theater without any other context, and the image just haunted me for years afterward. A sweaty, pistol-brandishing Harrison Ford, who I doubt I recognized as Han Solo or Indiana Jones because the likeness was inexact, and the persona was a complete departure. Then there was the flying car above sci-fi towers thrusting into the night sky. Finally, the cold, dead-eyed expression of a smoking woman with a 1940s-style fashion. Besides all the cool mood and still uncommon genre trappings, just the term Blade Runner captured my imagination. At the time, I recalled the precarious nature of running along a sharp situational precipice, though I later realized it was more likely along the lines of Mac the Knife, an assassin paid to guide a blade between someone's ribs. Whatever, I knew I wanted it. I don't recall if I read the comic or saw the movie on cable first, but both occurred around 1989. Most probably the comic first, as I was very disappointed in the movie for not living up to the impressive poster, and I doubt I'd have bought the comic afterward. Al Williamson's art was familiar from Marvel's later Star Wars adaptations, but it was a far better fit for a gritty near-future Los Angeles swimming in neon and Japanese cultural domination. I've always been a sucker for first-person narration and cynical observations, and Archie Goodwin did a surprisingly good job of boiling down a languid, ponderous film into its most compelling beats. I've seen the film a couple more times since, and while I own the director's cut without the controversial voiceover, I don't think I've yet watched it. I also eventually read Philip K. Dick's source novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, and at first pass preferred it to Blade Runner, but I revisited it a decade ago and wasn't so sure. It seems like whichever one I revisited last I liked best, but the truth is I want to like both the movie and the book better than I actually do, though I certainly respect and quote both. Anyway, maybe the comic is my favorite version after all.
Inside of me, take me down and love me all night long. Hold me close and make me strong. Take me down. Take me down tonight.
December of 1982 was a banner month. When I saw that blood trailing down Black Cat's arm on the cover to Peter Parker, The Spectacular Spider-Man number 76, I had to have it. I'd read one other Black Cat comic, but I had that bonding through familiarity that only children can produce with such ferocity. Unlike the Skeletor tease, Felicia really was stabbed, smushed, and slashed all to hell by the arms of Dr. Octopus and the forces of the Owl. Yes, the Owl had forces back then. Also, this all happened while she was in bondage wearing a skin-tight outfit with deep cleavage. In another contrast from He-Man, this was probably my first pass at sadomasochistic pulp exploitation, which I was perfectly alright with. There's even some great melodrama as Peter tries to pass a college final in a daze while thinking about his girlfriend in critical condition. Whatever his faults, Bill Mantlow could write circles around Kupperberg's functionality. Jim Mooney was a solid embellisher over the often stiff Al Milgram, giving him fluidity, softening the edges, adding romance, and yes, sex appeal. Milgram was great at conveying emotions, though. I haven't read the story in decades, but I remember it so vividly that I don't really need to.
She got the gold mine. I got the shaft. They split it right down the middle, and then they give her the better half. Well, it all sounds sort of funny, but it hurts too much to laugh. She got the gold mine, I got the shaft.
Then there's DC Comics Presents number 55, which I don't remember so well. I'm not really sure why I bought this one. I liked Superman, and he appeared to be crushed to death in a two-page spread, but it was a fake-out. I think I'd seen Parasite in a coloring book, or just thought he looked cool. I would have a heightened awareness of Airway from then on. Of the, oh hey, Airway, huh, variety. Horrible costume, dorky powers, then connection to Hal Jordan. Blech. I think there was a villainous train conductor riding a mini flying choo-choo in this. And I know the original Airwave wore roller skates that let him ride on top of telephones / power lines. That's something of a sort. I never really warmed to Bob Rozakis or much of DC's writing pool at that time. And Alex Saviek was sort of my personal Paul Kupperberg of art.
Greetings, Bat fans. This is Batman.
And Robin, the Boy Wonder.
And me too, Batmite.
Welcoming you to the new adventures of Batman. Watch us wage our never-ending battle of good versus evil.
Ride with us as we chase the greatest array of villains the world has ever seen, proving that crime does not pay.
Get set for thrills and action. Join me, Batman.
And me, Robin the Boy Wonder.
And that girl. And me too, Batmite.
In the super new adventures of Batman.
Finally, there was another awesome The Brave and the Bold, number 196. That title was a perfect gateway drug, with a generation's Batman writer and artist using him to introduce all manner of DC irregulars to new readers. So, of course, DC canceled it 4 issues later for a garbage X-Men knockoff, The Loathsome Outsiders. My affection for this take on Ragman outlived that for Black Cat, probably because there still aren't many humanist slumland five-and-dime superheroes running around. Turning him into a wimpy specter with a minority angle to trot out on Hanukkah was less than inspired. As with the Spider-Man, what sticks with me are images like Vietnam vet Rory Reagan standing at a sink, unable to wash the blood off his hands, or his father's drunken group of friends being slowly electrocuted. The identity switches were novel, and Jim Aparo drew the Caped Crusader with an unparalleled grace. Bob Haney's scripts were always a gas, but this one resonated in a way specific to a guy probably aware that his writing days were almost done, giving his all on the way out the door. That is a striking cover as well on a childhood favorite. So the Irredeemable Shag left a comment on the blog when this was first posted in 2012. He wrote, "I really enjoyed this post. Some nice insight into the mysterious origin of Frank. I applaud your memory. Amazing recall. That cover with Ragman looks great. I'm only familiar with the post-crisis Ragman, whom I like very much. Maybe I should seek out some pre-crisis Ragman stories. Any recommendations beyond, obviously, the issue pictured above?" And at the time, I pointed out that while I had read some of the Robert Kaniger, Joe Kubert issues of the Ragman solo series, they didn't really do much for me. I just really love this one story and didn't really have any other recommendations. Recent episodes of the podcast have received social media support from Scott Rowland, Coffee and Comics, Firestorm Fan, Paul Hicks, Iowa's Joe Crawford, Keith G. Baker, Kirk Spencer Hopes You Will Draw Sergeant Rock, Odell Abner Dracula, Old Desert Hymnal, Reggie, Secret Transmission Podcast, Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Siskoid, Tom Beach, Warlord Worlds, Adriano, The Batmanalist, Bub at Captain Sulu, Comics in the Golden Age, Doc Strange, Edir Araujo, History of Comics on Film, and Derek William Crabb in general, INW, Jeffrey Brown, Jesse Farrell, Jesse Torres, John D. Knoll, Justice First Dawn, Kamikaze Bear, Kyle Benning Likes Comics, Mr. Stars, Odell Abner Dracula, Prajvin Saxena, Punch Comics, Roy Huff, Slangward Scott, Agent of Girl, G-I-R-L, Superbound, Warlord Worlds, and Doug Zavisha. King Dinosaur wrote, "Ah, good year. I have the Batman and Atari Force comics." Odell Abner Dracula asked these guys and posted a pic from the Fisher-Price Adventure People. Mr. Stars also posted additional pics of the group.
Searching my mind for some truth to reveal. What thoughts are fantasy?